This is disc number 6.
The air in the ship is getting quite foul, and I have a headache most of the time. There's still plenty of oxygen, but the purifiers never really cleaned up all the messes after the liquids aboard started boiling in a vacuum. When things get too bad, I go down into the garage and bleed off some pure oxygen from the pods. There's been no reaction to any of my signals, and because of my orbital inclination, I'm getting slowly farther and farther away from TMA-2. Incidentally, the name you've given it is doubly inappropriate. There's still no trace of a magnetic field. At the moment, my closest approach is 60 miles. It will increase to about 100 as Iapetus rotates beneath me, then drop back to zero. I'll pass directly over the thing in 30 days, but that's too long to wait, and then it'll be in darkness anyway. Even now, it's only in sight for a few minutes before it falls below the horizon again. It's damn frustrating. I can't make any serious observations. So I'd like your approval of this plan. The space pods have ample Delta-V for a touchdown and a return to the ship. I want to go extra vehicular and make a close survey of the object. If it appears safe, I'll land beside it, or even on top of it. The ship will still be above my horizon while I'm going down, so I won't be out of touch for more than 90 minutes. I'm convinced that this is the only thing to do. I've come a billion miles. I don't want to be stopped by the last 60. For weeks, as it stared forever sunward with its strange senses, the Stargate had watched the approaching ship. Its makers had prepared it for many things, and this was one of them. It recognized what was climbing up toward it from the warm heart of the solar system. If it had been alive, it would have felt excitement, but such an emotion was wholly beyond its powers. Even if the ship had passed it by, it would not have known the slightest trace of disappointment. It had waited 3 million years. It was prepared to wait for eternity. It observed and noted and took no action as the visitor checked its speed with jets of incandescent gas. Presently, it felt the gentle touch of radiations trying to probe its secrets, and still it did nothing. Now, the ship was in orbit, circling low above the surface of this strangely piebald moon. It began to speak with blasts of radio waves, counting out the prime numbers from 1 to 11, over and over again. Soon these gave way to more complex signals at many frequencies, ultraviolet, infrared, X-rays. The Stargate made no reply. It had nothing to say. There was a long pause, then, before it observed that something was falling down toward it from the orbiting ship. It searched its memories, and the logic circuits made their decisions according to the orders given them long ago. Beneath the cold light of Saturn, the Stargate awakened its slumbering powers. Chapter 39. Into the Eye. Discovery looked just as he had last seen her from space, floating in lunar orbit with the moon taking up half the sky. Perhaps there was one slight change, he could not be sure, but some of the paint of her external lettering, announcing the purpose of various hatches, connections, umbilical plugs, and other attachments, had faded during its long exposure to the unshielded sun. That sun was now an object that no man would have recognized. It was far too bright to be a star, but one could look directly at its tiny disk without discomfort. It gave no heat at all. When Bowman held his ungloved hands in its rays as they streamed through the space pod's window, he could feel nothing upon his skin. He might have been trying to warm himself by the light of the moon. Not even the alien landscape 50 miles below reminded him more vividly of his remoteness from Earth. Now he was leaving, perhaps for the last time, the metal world that had been his home for so many months. Even if he never returned, the ship would continue to perform its duty, broadcasting instrument readings back to Earth until there was some final, catastrophic failure in its circuits. And if he did return, well, he could keep alive and perhaps even sane for a few more months. But that was all, for the hibernation systems were useless with no computer to monitor them. He could not possibly survive until Discovery 2 made its rendezvous with Iapetus 4 or 5 years hence. He put these thoughts behind him as the golden crescent of Saturn rose in the sky ahead. In all history, he was the only man to have seen this sight. To all other eyes, Saturn had always shown its whole illuminated disk, turned full toward the sun. Now it was a delicate bow, with the rings forming a thin line across it, like an arrow about to be loosed into the face of the sun itself. Also in the line of the rings was the bright star of Titan, and the fainter sparks of the other moons. Before this century was half gone, men would have visited them all, but whatever secrets they might hold, he would never know. The sharp-edged boundary of the blind white eye was sweeping toward him. There were only 100 miles to go, and he would be over his target in less than 10 minutes. He wished that there was some way of telling if his words were reaching Earth, now an hour and a half away at the speed of light. It would be the ultimate irony if, through some breakdown in the relay system, he disappeared into silence and no one ever knew what had happened to him. Discovery was still a brilliant star in the black sky far above. He was pulling ahead as he gained speed during his descent, but soon the pod's braking jets would slow him down and the ship would sail on out of sight, leaving him alone on this shining plain with the dark mystery at its center. A block of ebony was climbing above the horizon, eclipsing the stars ahead. He rolled the pod around its gyros and used full thrust to brake his orbital speed. In a long, flat arc, he descended toward the surface of Iapetus. On a world of higher gravity, the maneuver would have been far too extravagant of fuel. But here, the space pod weighed only a score of pounds. He had several minutes of hovering time before he would cut dangerously into his reserve and be stranded without any hope of return to the still-orbiting Discovery. Not, perhaps, that it made much difference. His altitude was still above 5 miles, and he was heading straight toward the huge, dark mass that soared in such geometrical perfection above the featureless plain. It was as blank as the flat, white surface beneath. Until now, he had not appreciated how enormous it really was. There were very few single buildings on Earth as large as this. His carefully measured photographs indicated a height of almost 2,000 feet, and as far as could be judged, its proportions were precisely the same as TMA-1's, that curious ratio 1:4:9. "I'm only 3 miles away now, holding altitude at 4,000 feet. Still not a sign of activity, nothing on any of the instruments. The faces seem absolutely smooth and polished. Surely you'd expect some meteorite damage after all this time. And there's no debris on the, I suppose one could call it the roof. No sign of any opening, either. I'd been hoping there might be some way in. Now I'm right above it, hovering 500 feet up. I don't want to waste any time, since Discovery will soon be out of range. I'm going to land. It's certainly solid enough. And if it isn't, I'll blast off at once."
"Just a minute. That's odd."
Bowman's voice died into the silence of utter bewilderment. He was not alarmed. He literally could not describe what he was seeing. He had been hanging above a large, flat rectangle 800 feet long and 200 wide, made of something that looked as solid as rock, but now it seemed to be receding from him. It was exactly like one of those optical illusions when a three-dimensional object can, by an effort of will, appear to turn inside out, its near and far sides suddenly interchanging. That was happening to this huge, apparently solid structure. Impossibly, incredibly, it was no longer a monolith rearing high above a flat plain. What had seemed to be its roof had dropped away to infinite depths. For one dizzy moment he seemed to be looking down into a vertical shaft, a rectangular duct which defied the laws of perspective, for its size did not decrease with distance. The eye of Iapetus had blinked, as if to remove an irritating speck of dust. David Bowman had time for just one broken sentence, which the waiting men in mission control, 900 million miles away and 80 minutes in the future, were never to forget.
"The thing's hollow. It goes on forever, and, oh my God, it's full of stars."
Chapter 40. Exit. The Stargate opened. The Stargate closed. In a moment of time too short to be measured, space turned and twisted upon itself. Then Iapetus was alone once more, as it had been for 3 million years. Alone, except for a deserted but not yet derelict ship, sending back to its makers messages which they could neither believe nor understand. Part 6. Through the Stargate. Chapter 41. Grand Central. There was no sense of motion, but he was falling toward those impossible stars, shining there in the dark heart of a moon. No, that was not where they really were, he felt certain. He wished, now that it was far too late, that he had paid more attention to those theories of hyperspace, of transdimensional ducts. To David Bowman, they were theories no longer. Perhaps that monolith on Iapetus was hollow. Perhaps the roof was only an illusion or some kind of diaphragm that had opened to let him through. But into what? As far as he could trust his senses, he appeared to be dropping vertically down a huge rectangular shaft, several thousand feet deep. He was moving faster and faster, but the far end never changed its size and remained always at the same distance from him. Only the stars moved, at first so slowly that it was some time before he realized that they were escaping out of the frame that held them. But in a little while it was obvious that the star field was expanding, as if it was rushing toward him at an inconceivable speed. The expansion was non-linear. The stars at the center hardly seemed to move, while those toward the edge accelerated more and more swiftly until they became streaks of light just before they vanished from view. There were always others to replace them, flowing into the center of the field from an apparently inexhaustible source. Bowman wondered what would happen if a star came straight toward him. Would it continue to expand until he plunged directly into the face of a sun? But not one came near enough to show a disk. Eventually they all veered aside and streaked over the edge of their rectangular frame, and still the far end of the shaft came no closer. It was almost as if the walls were moving with him, carrying him to his unknown destination. Or perhaps he was really motionless, and space was moving past him. Not only space, he suddenly realized, was involved in whatever was happening to him now. The clock on the pod's small instrument panel was also behaving strangely. Normally, the numbers in the tenths of a second window flickered past so quickly that it was almost impossible to read them. Now, they were appearing and disappearing at discrete intervals, and he could count them off one by one without difficulty. The seconds themselves were passing with incredible slowness, as if time itself were coming to a stop. At last, the tenth of a second counter froze between 5 and 6. Yet he could still think, and even observe, as the ebon walls flowed past at a speed that might have been anything between 0 and 1,000,000 times the velocity of light. Somehow, he was not in the least surprised, nor was he alarmed. On the contrary, he felt a sense of calm expectation, such as he had once known when the space medics had tested him with hallucinogenic drugs. The world around him was strange and wonderful, but there was nothing to fear. He had traveled these millions of miles in search of mystery, and now, it seemed, the mystery was coming to him. The rectangle ahead was growing lighter. The luminous star streaks were paling against a milky sky whose brilliance increased moment by moment. It seemed as if the space pod was heading toward a bank of cloud, uniformly illuminated by the rays of an invisible sun. He was emerging from the tunnel. The far end, which until now had remained at that same indeterminate distance, neither approaching nor receding, had suddenly started to obey the normal laws of perspective. It was coming closer and steadily widening before him. At the same time, he felt that he was moving upward, and for a fleeting instant he wondered if he had fallen right through Iapetus and was now ascending from the other side. But even before the space pod soared out into the open, he knew that this place had nothing to do with Iapetus or with any world within the experience of man. There was no atmosphere, for he could see all details unblurred, clear down to an incredibly remote and flat horizon. He must be above a world of enormous size, perhaps one much larger than Earth, yet despite its extent, all the surface that Bowman could see was tessellated into obviously artificial patterns that must have been miles on a side. It was like the jigsaw puzzle of a giant that played with planets. And at the centers of many of those squares and triangles and polygons were gaping black shafts, twins of the chasm from which he had just emerged. Yet the sky above was stranger, and in its way more disturbing than even the improbable land beneath, for there were no stars. Neither was there the blackness of space. There was only a softly glowing milkiness that gave the impression of infinite distance. Bowman remembered a description he had once heard of the dreaded Antarctic whiteout, like being inside a ping-pong ball. Those words could be applied perfectly to this weird place, but the explanation must be utterly different. This sky could be no meteorological effect of mist and snow. There was a perfect vacuum here. Then, as Bowman's eyes grew accustomed to the nacreous glow that filled the heavens, he became aware of another detail. The sky was not, as he had thought at first glance, completely empty. Dotted overhead, quite motionless and forming apparently random patterns, were myriads of tiny black specks. They were difficult to see, for they were mere points of darkness, but once detected they were quite unmistakable. They reminded Bowman of something, something so familiar yet so insane that he refused to accept the parallel until logic forced it upon him. Those black holes in the white sky were stars. He might have been looking at a photographic negative of the Milky Way. "Where in God's name am I?" Bowman asked himself, and even as he posed the question, he felt certain that he could never know the answer. It seemed that space had been turned inside out. This was not a place for man. Though the capsule was comfortably warm, he felt suddenly cold and was afflicted by an almost uncontrollable trembling. He wanted to close his eyes and shut out the pearly nothingness that surrounded him, but that was the act of a coward, and he would not yield to it. The pierced and faceted planet slowly rolled beneath him without any real change of scenery. He guessed that he was about 10 miles above the surface and should be able to see any signs of life with ease, but this whole world was deserted. Intelligence had come here, worked its will upon it, and gone its way again. Then he noticed, humped above the flat plain, perhaps 20 miles away, a roughly cylindrical pile of debris that could only be the carcass of a gigantic ship. It was too distant for him to see any details, and it passed out of sight within a few seconds, but he could make out broken ribs and dully gleaming sheets of metal that had been partly peeled off like the skin of an orange. He wondered how many thousands of years the wreck had lain here on this deserted checkerboard, and what manner of creatures had sailed it between the stars. Then he forgot the derelict, for something was coming up over the horizon. At first it looked like a flat disk, but that was because it was heading almost directly toward him. As it approached and passed beneath, he saw that it was spindle-shaped and several hundred feet long. Though there were faintly visible bands here and there along its length, it was hard to focus upon them. The object appeared to be vibrating or perhaps spinning at a very rapid rate. It tapered to a point at either end, and there was no sign of propulsion. Only one thing about it was familiar to human eyes, and that was its color. If it was indeed a solid artifact and not an optical phantom, then its makers perhaps shared some of the emotions of men. But they certainly did not share their limitations, for the spindle appeared to be made of gold. Bowman moved his head to the rear-view system to watch the thing drop behind. It had ignored him completely, and now he saw that it was falling out of the sky down toward one of those thousands of great slots. A few seconds later, it disappeared in a final flash of gold as it dived into the planet. He was alone again, beneath that sinister sky, and the sense of isolation and remoteness was more overwhelming than ever. Then he saw that he also was sinking down toward the mottled surface of the giant world, and that another of the rectangular chasms yawned immediately below. The empty sky closed above him. The clock crawled to rest, and once again his pod was falling between infinite ebon walls toward another distant patch of stars. But now he was sure that he was not returning to the solar system, and in a flash of insight that might have been wholly spurious, he knew what this thing must surely be. It was some kind of cosmic switching device, routing the traffic of the stars through unimaginable dimensions of space and time. He was passing through a grand central station of the galaxy. Chapter 42. The Alien Sky. Far ahead, the walls of the slot were becoming dimly visible once more in the faint light diffusing downward from some still hidden source. And then the darkness was abruptly whipped away as the tiny space pod hurtled upward into a sky ablaze with stars. He was back in space as he knew it, but a single glance told him that he was light centuries from Earth. He did not even attempt to find any of the familiar constellations that since the beginning of history had been the friends of man. Perhaps none of the stars that now blazed around him had ever been seen by the unaided human eye. Most of them were concentrated in a glowing belt, broken here and there with dark bands of obscuring cosmic dust, which completely circled the sky. It was like the Milky Way, but scores of times brighter. Bowman wondered if this was indeed his own galaxy, seen from a point much closer to its brilliant, crowded center. He hoped that it was. Then he would not be so far from home. But this, he realized at once, was a childish thought. He was so inconceivably remote from his solar system that it made little difference whether he was in his own galaxy or the most distant one that any telescope had ever glimpsed. He looked back to see the thing from which he was rising and had another shock. Here was no giant, multifaceted world, nor any duplicate of Iapetus. There was nothing except an inky shadow against the stars, like a doorway opening from a darkened room into a still darker night. Even as he watched, that doorway closed. It did not recede from him. It slowly filled with stars, as if a rent in the fabric of space had been repaired. Then he was alone beneath the alien sky. The space pod was slowly turning, and as it did so, it brought fresh wonders into view. First, there was a perfectly spherical swarm of stars, becoming more and more closely packed toward the center until its heart was a continuous glow of light. Its outer edges were ill-defined, a slowly thinning halo of suns that merged imperceptibly into the background of more distant stars. This glorious apparition, Bowman knew, was a globular cluster. He was looking upon something that no human eye had ever seen, save as a smudge of light in the field of a telescope. He could not remember the distance to the nearest known cluster, but he was sure that there were none within 1,000 light-years of the solar system. The pod continued its slow rotation to disclose an even stranger sight, a huge red sun, many times larger than the moon as seen from Earth. Bowman could look straight into its face without discomfort. Judging by its color, it was no hotter than a glowing coal. Here and there, set into the somber red, were rivers of bright yellow, incandescent Amazons, meandering for thousands of miles before they lost themselves in the deserts of this dying sun. Dying? No. That was a wholly false impression, born of human experience and the emotions aroused by the hues of sunset or the glow of fading embers. This was a star that had left behind the fiery extravagances of its youth, had raced through the violets and blues and greens of the spectrum in a few fleeting billions of years, and now had settled down to a peaceful maturity of unimaginable length. All that had gone before was not 1,000th of what was yet to come. The story of this star had barely begun. The pod had ceased to roll. The great red sun lay straight ahead. Though there was no sense of motion, Bowman knew that he was still gripped by whatever controlling force had brought him here from Saturn. All the science and engineering skill of Earth seemed hopelessly primitive now against the powers that were carrying him to some unimaginable fate. He stared into the sky ahead, trying to pick out the goal toward which he was being taken, perhaps some planet circling this great sun. But there was nothing that showed any visible disk or exceptional brightness. If there were planets orbiting here, he could not distinguish them from the stellar background. Then he noticed that something strange was happening on the very edge of the sun's crimson disk. A white glow had appeared there and was rapidly waxing in brilliance. He wondered if he was seeing one of those sudden eruptions or flares that trouble most stars from time to time. The light became brighter and bluer. It began to spread along the edge of the sun, whose blood-red hues paled swiftly by comparison. It was almost, Bowman told himself, smiling at the absurdity of the thought, as if he were watching sunrise on a sun. And so indeed he was. Above the burning horizon lifted something no larger than a star, but so brilliant that the eye could not bear to look upon it. A mere point of blue-white radiance, like an electric arc, was moving at unbelievable speed across the face of the great sun. It must be very close to its giant companion, for immediately below it, drawn upward by its gravitational pull, was a column of flame thousands of miles high. It was as if a tidal wave of fire was marching forever along the equator of this star, in vain pursuit of the searing apparition in its sky. That pinpoint of incandescence must be a white dwarf, one of those strange, fierce little stars no larger than the Earth, yet containing a million times its mass. Such ill-matched stellar couples were not uncommon, but Bowman had never dreamed that one day he would see such a pair with his own eyes. The white dwarf had transited almost half the disk of its companion. It must take only minutes to make a complete orbit, when Bowman was at last certain that he, too, was moving. Ahead of him, one of the stars was becoming rapidly brighter and was beginning to drift against its background. It must be some small, close body, perhaps the world toward which he was traveling. It was upon him with unexpected speed, and he saw that it was not a world at all. A dully gleaming cobweb or latticework of metal, hundreds of miles in extent, grew out of nowhere until it filled the sky. Scattered across its continent-wide surface were structures that must have been as large as cities, but which appeared to be machines. Around many of these were assembled scores of smaller objects, ranged in neat rows and columns. Bowman had passed several such groups before he realized that they were fleets of spaceships. He was flying over a gigantic orbital parking lot. Because there were no familiar objects by which he could judge the scale of the scene flashing by below, it was almost impossible to estimate the size of the vessels hanging there in space, but they were certainly enormous. Some must have been miles in length. They were of many different designs, spheres, faceted crystals, slim pencils, ovoids, disks. This must be one of the meeting places for the commerce of the stars. Or it had been, perhaps a million years ago. For nowhere could Bowman see any sign of activity. This sprawling spaceport was as dead as the moon. He knew it not only by the absence of all movement, but by such unmistakable signs as great gaps torn in the metal cobweb by the wasp-like blunderings of asteroids that must have smashed through it eons ago. This was no longer a parking lot. It was a cosmic junk heap. He had missed its builders by ages, and with that realization Bowman felt a sudden sinking of his heart. Though he had not known what to expect, at least he had hoped to meet some intelligence from the stars. Now, it seemed, he was too late. He had been caught in an ancient, automatic trap, set for some unknown purpose, and still operating when its makers had long since passed away. It had swept him across the galaxy and dumped him, with how many others, in this celestial Sargasso, doomed soon to die when his air was exhausted. Well, it was unreasonable to expect more. Already he had seen wonders for which many men would have sacrificed their lives. He thought of his dead companions. He had no cause for complaint. Then he saw that the derelict spaceport was still sliding past him with undiminished speed. He was sweeping over its outlying suburbs. Its ragged edge went by, and no longer partially eclipsed the stars. In a few more minutes it had fallen behind. His fate did not lie here, but far ahead, in the huge crimson sun toward which the space pod was now unmistakably falling. Chapter 43 Inferno. Now there was only the red sun, filling the sky from side to side. He was so close that its surface was no longer frozen into immobility by sheer scale. There were luminous nodules moving to and fro, cyclones of ascending and descending gas, prominences slowly rocketing toward the heavens. Slowly? They must be rising at 1,000,000 miles an hour for their movement to be visible to his eye. He did not even attempt to grasp the scale of the inferno toward which he was descending. The immensities of Saturn and Jupiter had defeated him during Discovery's flyby in that solar system now unknown gigamiles away. But everything he saw here was 100 times larger still. He could do nothing but accept the images that were flooding into his mind without attempting to interpret them. As that sea of fire expanded behind him, Bowman should have known fear, but, curiously enough, he now felt only a mild apprehension. It was not that his mind was benumbed with wonders. Logic told him that he must surely be under the protection of some controlling and almost omnipotent intelligence. He was now so close to the red sun that he would have been burned up in a moment if its radiation had not been held at bay by some invisible screen. And during his voyage, he had been subjected to accelerations that should have crushed him instantly, yet he had felt nothing. If so much trouble had been taken to preserve him, there was still cause for hope. The space pod was now moving along a shallow arc almost parallel to the surface of the star, but slowly descending toward it. And now, for the first time, Bowman became aware of sounds. There was a faint, continuous roar, broken from time to time by crackles like tearing paper or distant lightning. This could be only the feeblest echo of an unimaginable cacophony. The atmosphere surrounding him must be racked by concussions that could tear any material object to atoms, yet he was protected from this shattering tumult as effectively as from the heat. Though ridges of flames, thousands of miles high, were rising and slowly collapsing around him, he was completely insulated from all this violence. The energies of the star raved past him as if they were in another universe. The pod moved sedately through their midst, unbuffeted and unscorched. Bowman's eyes, no longer hopelessly confused by the strangeness and grandeur of the scene, began to pick out details which must have been there before but which he had not yet perceived. The surface of this star was no formless chaos. There was pattern here, as in everything that nature created. He noticed first the little whirlpools of gas, probably no larger than Asia or Africa, that wandered over the surface of the star. Sometimes he could look directly down into one of them to see darker, cooler regions far below. Curiously enough, there appeared to be no sunspots. Perhaps they were a disease peculiar to the star that shone on Earth. And there were occasional clouds, like wisps of smoke blown before a gale. Perhaps they were indeed smoke, for this sun was so cold that real fire could exist here. Chemical compounds could be born and could live for a few seconds before they were again ripped apart by the fiercer nuclear violence that surrounded them. The horizon was growing brighter, its color changing from gloomy red to yellow to blue to blistering violet. The white dwarf was coming up over the horizon, dragging its tidal wave of star stuff behind it. Bowman shielded his eyes from the intolerable glare of the little sun and focused on the troubled starscape which its gravitational field was sucking skyward. Once he had seen a waterspout moving across the face of the Caribbean. This tower of flame had almost the same shape, only the scale was slightly different, for at its base the column was probably wider than the planet Earth. And then, immediately beneath him, Bowman noticed something which was surely new, since he could hardly have overlooked it if it had been there before. moving across the ocean of glowing gas were myriads of bright beads. They shone with a pearly light which waxed and waned in a period of a few seconds, and they were all traveling in the same direction, like salmon moving upstream. Sometimes they weaved back and forth so that their paths intertwined, but they never touched. There were thousands of them, and the longer Bowman stared, the more convinced he became that their motion was purposeful. They were too far away for him to make out any details of their structure. That he could see them at all in this colossal panorama meant that they must be scores, perhaps hundreds of miles across. If they were organized entities, they were leviathans indeed, built to match the scale of the world they inhabited. Perhaps they were only clouds of plasma, given temporary stability by some odd combination of natural forces, like the short-lived spheres of ball lightning that still puzzled terrestrial scientists. That was an easy, and perhaps soothing, explanation, but as Bowman looked down upon that star-wide streaming, he could not really believe it. Those glittering nodes of light knew where they were going. They were deliberately converging upon the pillar of fire raised by the white dwarf as it orbited overhead. Bowman stared once more at that ascending column, now marching along the horizon beneath the tiny, massive star that ruled it. Could it be pure imagination? Or were there patches of brighter luminosity creeping up that great geyser of gas, as if myriads of shining sparks had combined into whole continents of phosphorescence? The idea was almost beyond fantasy, but perhaps he was watching nothing less than a migration from star to star, across a bridge of fire. Whether it was a movement of mindless cosmic beasts driven across space by some lemming-like urge, or a vast concourse of intelligent entities, he would probably never know. He was moving through a new order of creation, of which few men had ever dreamed. Beyond the realms of sea and land and air and space lay the realms of fire, which he alone had been privileged to glimpse. It was too much to expect that he would also understand. Chapter 44. Reception. The pillar of fire was marching over the edge of the sun like a storm passing beyond the horizon. The scurrying flecks of light no longer moved across the redly glowing starscape, still thousands of miles below. Inside his space pod, protected from an environment that could annihilate him within a millisecond, David Bowman awaited whatever had been prepared. The white dwarf was sinking fast as it hurtled along its orbit. Presently, it touched the horizon, set it aflame, and disappeared. A false twilight fell upon the inferno beneath, and in the sudden change of illumination, Bowman became aware that something was happening in the space around him. The world of the red sun seemed to ripple, as if he were looking at it through running water. For a moment, he wondered if this was some refractive effect, perhaps caused by the passage of an unusually violent shock wave through the tortured atmosphere in which he was immersed. The light was fading. It seemed that a second twilight was about to fall. Involuntarily, Bowman looked upward, then checked himself sheepishly, as he remembered that here the main source of light was not the sky, but the blazing world below. It seemed as if walls of some material like smoked glass were thickening around him, cutting out the red glow and obscuring the view. It became darker and darker. The faint roar of the stellar hurricanes also faded out. The space pod was floating in silence, and in night. A moment later, there was the softest of bumps as it settled on some hard surface and came to rest. To rest on what? Bowman asked himself incredulously. Then light returned, and incredulity gave way to a heart-sinking despair. For as he saw what lay around him, he knew that he must be mad. He was prepared, he thought, for any wonder. The only thing he had never expected was the utterly commonplace. The space pod was resting on the polished floor of an elegant, anonymous hotel suite that might have been in any large city on Earth. He was staring into a living room with a coffee table, a divan, a dozen chairs, a writing desk, various lamps, a half-filled bookcase with some magazines lying on it, and even a bowl of flowers. Van Gogh's Bridge at Arles was hanging on one wall, Wyeth's Christina's World on another. He felt confident that when he pulled open the drawer of that desk, he would find a Gideon Bible inside it. If he was indeed mad, his delusions were beautifully organized. Everything was perfectly real. Nothing vanished when he turned his back. The only incongruous element in the scene, and that certainly a major one, was the space pod itself. For many minutes, Bowman did not move from his seat. He half expected the vision around him to go away, but it remained as solid as anything he had ever seen in his life. It was real, or else a phantom of the senses so superbly contrived that there was no way of distinguishing it from reality. Perhaps it was some kind of test. If so, not only his fate, but that of the human race might well depend upon his actions in the next few minutes. He could sit here and wait for something to happen, or he could open the pod and step outside to challenge the reality of the scene around him. The floor appeared to be solid. At least it was bearing the weight of the space pod. He was not likely to fall through it, whatever it might really be. But there was still the question of air. For all that he could tell, this room might be in vacuum, or might contain a poisonous atmosphere. He thought it very unlikely. No one would go to all this trouble without attending to such an essential detail. But he did not propose to take unnecessary risks. In any event, his years of training made him wary of contamination. He was reluctant to expose himself to an unknown environment until he knew that there was no alternative. This place looked like a hotel room somewhere in the United States. That did not alter the fact that in reality he must be hundreds of light years from the solar system. He closed the helmet of his suit, sealing himself in, and actuated the hatch of the space pod. There was a brief hiss of pressure equalization, then he stepped out into the room. As far as he could tell, he was in a perfectly normal gravity field. He raised one arm, then let it fall freely. It flopped to his side in less than a second. This made everything seem doubly unreal. Here he was, wearing a spacesuit, standing, when he should have been floating, outside a vehicle which could only function properly in the absence of gravity. All his normal astronaut's reflexes were upset. He had to think before he made every movement. Like a man in a trance, he walked slowly from his bare, unfurnished half of the room toward the hotel suite. It did not, as he had almost expected, disappear as he approached, but remained perfectly real, and apparently perfectly solid. He stopped beside the coffee table. On it sat a conventional Bell System vision phone, complete with a local directory. He bent down and picked up the volume with his clumsy gloved hands. It bore, in the familiar type he had seen thousands of times, the name Washington, D.C. Then he looked more closely, and for the first time he had objective proof that, although this might be real, he was not on Earth. He could read only the word Washington. The rest of the printing was a blur, as if it had been copied from a newspaper photograph. He opened the book at random and riffled through the pages. They were all blank sheets of crisp white material, which was certainly not paper, though it looked very much like it. He lifted the telephone receiver and pressed it against the plastic of his helmet. If there had been a dialing sound, he could have heard it through the conducting material, but as he had expected, there was only silence. So, it was all a fake, though a fantastically careful one, and it was clearly not intended to deceive, but rather, he hoped, to reassure. That was a very comforting thought. Nevertheless, he would not remove his suit until he had completed his voyage of exploration. All the furniture seemed sound and solid enough. He tried the chairs, and they supported his weight. But the drawers in the desk would not open. They were dummies. So were the books and magazines. Like the telephone directory, only the titles were readable. They formed an odd selection, mostly rather trashy bestsellers, a few sensational works of nonfiction, and some well-publicized autobiographies. There was nothing less than 3 years old, and little of any intellectual content. Not that it mattered, for the books could not even be taken down from the shelves. There were two doors that opened readily enough. The first one took him into a small but comfortable bedroom, fitted with a bed, bureau, two chairs, light switches that actually worked, and a clothes closet. He opened this and found himself looking at four suits, a dressing gown, a dozen white shirts, and several sets of underwear, all neatly draped from hangers. He took down one of the suits and inspected it carefully. As far as his gloved hands could judge, it was made of material that was more like fur than wool. It was also a little out of style. On Earth, no one had been wearing single-breasted suits for at least 4 years. Next to the bedroom was a bathroom, complete with fittings which, he was relieved to note, were not dummies, but worked in a perfectly normal manner. And after that was a kitchenette with electric cooker, refrigerator, storage cupboards, crockery and cutlery, sink, table and chairs. Bowman began to explore this not only with curiosity, but with mounting hunger. First, he opened the refrigerator, and a wave of cold mist rolled out. The shelves were well stocked with packages and cans, all of them looking perfectly familiar from a distance, though at close quarters their proprietary labels were blurred and unreadable. However, there was a notable absence of eggs, milk, butter, meat, fruit, or any other unprocessed food. The refrigerator held only items that had already been packaged in some way. Bowman picked up a carton of a familiar breakfast cereal, thinking as he did so that it was odd to keep this frozen. The moment he lifted the package, he knew that it certainly did not contain cornflakes. It was much too heavy. He ripped open the lid and examined the contents. The box contained a slightly moist, blue substance of about the weight and texture of bread pudding. Apart from its odd color, it looked quite appetizing. "But this is ridiculous," Bowman told himself. "I am almost certainly being watched, and I must look like an idiot wearing this suit. If this is some kind of intelligence test, I've probably failed already." Without further hesitation, he walked back into the bedroom and began to undo the clamp of his helmet. When it was loose, he lifted the helmet a fraction of an inch, cracked the seal, and took a cautious sniff. As far as he could tell, he was breathing perfectly normal air. He dropped the helmet on the bed and began, thankfully and rather stiffly, to divest himself of his suit. When he had finished, he stretched, took a few deep breaths, and carefully hung the spacesuit up among the more conventional articles of clothing in the closet. It looked rather odd there, but the compulsive tidiness that Bowman shared with all astronauts would never have allowed him to leave it anywhere else. Then he walked quickly back into the kitchen and began to inspect the cereal box at closer quarters. The blue bread pudding had a faint, spicy smell, something like a macaroon. Bowman weighed it in his hand, then broke off a piece and cautiously sniffed at it. Though he felt sure now that there would be no deliberate attempt to poison him, there was always the possibility of mistakes, especially in a matter so complex as biochemistry. He nibbled at a few crumbs, then chewed and swallowed the fragment of food. It was excellent, though the flavor was so elusive as to be almost indescribable. If he closed his eyes, he could imagine it was meat, or wholemeal bread, or even dried fruit. Unless there were unexpected after-effects, he had no cause to fear starvation. When he had eaten just a few mouthfuls of the substance, and already felt quite satisfied, he looked for something to drink. There were a half a dozen cans of beer, again of a famous brand, at the back of the refrigerator, and he pressed the tab on one of them to open it. The pre-stressed metal lid popped off along its strain lines exactly as usual, but the can did not contain beer. To Bowman's surprised disappointment, it held more of the blue food. In a few seconds, he had opened half a dozen of the other packages and cans. Whatever their labels, their contents were the same. It seemed that his diet was going to be a little monotonous, and that he would have nothing but water to drink. He filled a glass from the kitchen faucet and sipped at it cautiously. He spat out the first few drops at once. The taste was terrible. Then, rather ashamed of his instinctive reaction, he forced himself to drink the rest. That first sip had been enough to identify the liquid. It tasted terrible because it had no taste at all. The faucet was supplying pure, distilled water. His unknown hosts were obviously taking no chances with his health. Feeling much refreshed, he then had a quick shower. There was no soap, which was another minor inconvenience, but there was a very efficient hot air dryer in which he luxuriated for a while before trying on underpants, vest, and dressing gown from the clothes closet. After that, he lay down on the bed, stared up at the ceiling, and tried to make sense of his fantastic situation. He had made little progress when he was distracted by another line of thought. Immediately above the bed was the usual hotel-type ceiling TV screen. He had assumed that, like the telephone and books, it was a dummy. But the control unit on its swinging bedside arm looked so realistic that he could not resist playing with it, and as his fingers touched the on sensor disc, the screen lit up. Feverishly, he started to tap out channel selector codes at random, and almost at once he got his first picture. It was a well-known African news commentator discussing the attempts being made to preserve the last remnants of his country's wildlife. Bowman listened for a few seconds, so captivated by the sound of a human voice that he did not in the least care what it was talking about. Then he changed channels. In the next 5 minutes, he got a symphony orchestra playing Walton's violin concerto, a discussion on the sad state of the legitimate theater, a western, a demonstration of a new headache cure, a panel game in some oriental language, a psychodrama, 3 news commentaries, a football game, a lecture on solid geometry in Russian, and several tuning signals and data transmissions. It was, in fact, a perfectly normal selection from the world's TV programs, and apart from the psychological uplift it gave him, it confirmed one suspicion that had already been forming in his mind. All the programs were about 2 years old. That was around the time TMA-1 had been discovered, and it was hard to believe that this was a pure coincidence. Something had been monitoring the radio waves. That Eben Block had been busier than men had suspected. He continued to wander across the spectrum and suddenly recognized a familiar scene. Here was this very suite, now occupied by a celebrated actor who was furiously denouncing an unfaithful mistress. The woman looked with a shock of recognition upon the living room he had just left, and when the camera followed the indignant couple toward the bedroom, he involuntarily looked toward the door to see if anyone was entering. So that was how this reception area had been prepared for him. His hosts had based their ideas of terrestrial living upon TV programs. His feeling that he was inside a movie set was almost literally true. He had learned all that he wished to for the moment and turned off the set. "What do I do now?" he asked himself, locking his fingers behind his head and staring up at the blank screen. He was physically and emotionally exhausted, yet it seemed impossible that one could sleep in such fantastic surroundings, and farther from Earth than any man in history had ever been. But the comfortable bed and the instinctive wisdom of the body conspired together against his will. He fumbled for the light switch, and the room was plunged into darkness. Within seconds, he had passed beyond the reach of dreams. So, for the last time, David Bowman slept. Chapter 45. Recapitulation. There being no further use for it, the furniture of the suite dissolved back into the mind of its creator. Only the bed remained, and the walls, shielding this fragile organism from the energies it could not yet control. In his sleep, David Bowman stirred restlessly. He did not wake, nor did he dream, but he was no longer wholly unconscious. Like a fog creeping through a forest, something invaded his mind. He sensed it only dimly, for the full impact would have destroyed him as surely as the fires raging beyond these walls. Beneath that dispassionate scrutiny, he felt neither hope nor fear. All emotion had been leached away. He seemed to be floating in free space while around him stretched in all directions an infinite geometrical grid of dark lines or threads, along which moved tiny nodes of light, some slowly, some at dazzling speed. Once he had peered through a microscope at a cross-section of a human brain, and in its network of nerve fibers had glimpsed the same labyrinthine complexity. But that had been dead and static, whereas this transcended life itself. He knew, or believed he knew, that he was watching the operation of some gigantic mind, contemplating the universe of which he was so tiny a part. The vision or illusion, lasted only a moment. Then the crystalline planes and lattices and the interlocking perspectives of moving light flickered out of existence as David Bowman moved into a realm of consciousness that no man had experienced before. At first, it seemed that time itself was running backward. Even this marvel he was prepared to accept before he realized the subtler truth. The springs of memory were being trapped. In controlled recollection, he was reliving the past. There was the hotel suite. There the space pod. There the burning starscapes of the red sun. There the shining core of the galaxy. There the gateway through which he had reemerged into the universe. And not only vision, but all the sense impressions and all the emotions he had felt at the time were racing past more and more swiftly. His life was unreeling like a tape recorder playing back at ever-increasing speed. Now he was once more aboard the Discovery, and the rings of Saturn filled the sky. Before that, he was repeating his final dialogue with Hal. He was seeing Frank Poole leave on his last mission. He was hearing the voice of Earth assuring him that all was well. And even as he relived these events, he knew that all indeed was well. He was retrogressing down the corridors of time, being drained of knowledge and experience as he swept back toward his childhood. But nothing was being lost. All that he had ever been at every moment of his life was being transferred to safer keeping. Even as one David Bowman ceased to exist, another became immortal. Faster, faster he moved back into forgotten years and into a simpler world. Faces he had once loved and had thought lost beyond recall smiled at him sweetly. He smiled back with fondness and without pain. Now, at last, the headlong regression was slackening. The wells of memory were nearly dry. Time flowed more and more sluggishly, approaching a moment of stasis, as a swinging pendulum at the limit of its arc seems frozen for one eternal instant before the next cycle begins. The timeless instant passed. The pendulum reversed its swing. In an empty room, floating amid the fires of a double star 20,000 light-years from Earth, a baby opened its eyes and began to cry. Chapter 46, Transformation. Then it became silent as it saw that it was no longer alone. A ghostly, glimmering rectangle had formed in the empty air. It solidified into a crystal tablet, lost its transparency, and became suffused with a pale, milky luminescence. Tantalizing, ill-defined phantoms moved across its surface and in its depths. They coalesced into bars of lights and shadow, then formed intermeshing, spoked patterns that began slowly to rotate, in time with the pulsing rhythm that now seemed to fill the whole of space. It was a spectacle to grasp and hold the attention of any child, or of any man-ape. But as it had been 3 million years before, it was only the outward manifestation of forces too subtle to be consciously perceived. It was merely a toy to distract the senses, while the real processing was carried out at far deeper levels of the mind. This time, the processing was swift and certain as the new design was woven. For in the eons since their last meeting, much had been learned by the weaver, and the material on which he practiced his art was now of an infinitely finer texture. But whether it should be permitted to form part of his still-growing tapestry, only the future could tell. With eyes that already held more than human intentness, the baby stared into the depths of the crystal monolith, seeing but not yet understanding the mysteries that lay beyond. It knew that it had come home, that here was the origin of many races besides its own, but it knew also that it could not stay. Beyond this moment lay another birth, stranger than any in the past. Now the moment had come. The glowing patterns no longer echoed the secrets in the crystal's heart. As they died, so too the protective walls faded back into the non-existence from which they had briefly emerged, and the red sun filled the sky. The metal and plastic of the forgotten space pod and the clothing once worn by an entity who had called himself David Bowman flashed into flame. The last links with Earth were gone, resolved back into their component atoms. But the child scarcely noticed as he adjusted himself to the comfortable glow of his new environment. He still needed for a little while, this shell of matter as the focus of his powers. His indestructible body was his mind's present image of itself, and for all his powers he knew that he was still a baby. So he would remain until he had decided on a new form, or had passed beyond the necessities of matter. And now it was time to go, though in one sense he would never leave this place where he had been reborn, for he would always be part of the entity that used this double star for its unfathomable purposes. The direction, though not the nature, of his destiny was clear before him, and there was no need to trace the devious path by which he had come. With the instincts of 3 million years, he now perceived that there were more ways than one behind the back of space. The ancient mechanisms of the Stargate had served him well, but he would not need them again. The glimmering rectangular shape that had once seemed no more than a slab of crystal still floated before him, indifferent as he was to the harmless flames of the inferno beneath. It encapsulated yet unfathomed secrets of space and time, but some at least he now understood and was able to command. How obvious, how necessary was that mathematical ratio of its sides, the quadratic sequence 1, 4, 9. And how naive to have imagined that the series ended at this point in only 3 dimensions. He focused his mind upon these geometrical simplicities, and as his thoughts brushed against it, the empty framework filled with the darkness of the interstellar night. The glow of the red sun faded, or rather seemed to recede in all directions at once, and there before him was the luminous whirlpool of the galaxy. It might have been some beautiful, incredibly detailed model embedded in a block of plastic, but it was the reality, grasped as a whole with senses now more subtle than vision. If he wished, he could focus his attention upon any one of its 100 billion stars, and he could do much more than that. Here he was, adrift in this great river of suns, halfway between the banked fires of the galactic core and the lonely scattered sentinel stars of the rim, and here he wished to be, on the far side of this chasm in the sky, this serpentine band of darkness, empty of all stars. He knew that this formless chaos, visible only by the glow that limned its edges from fire mists far beyond, was the still unused stuff of creation, the raw material of evolutions yet to be. Here, time had not begun. Not until the suns that now burned were long since dead would light and life reshape this void. Unwittingly, he had crossed it once. Now he must cross it again, this time of his own volition. The thought filled him with a sudden, freezing terror, so that for a moment he was wholly disoriented, and his new vision of the universe trembled and threatened to shatter into 1,000 fragments. It was not fear of the galactic gulfs that chilled his soul, but a more profound disquiet stemming from the unborn future. For he had left behind the timescales of his human origin. Now, as he contemplated that band of starless night, he knew his first intimations of the eternity that yawned before him. Then he remembered that he would never be alone, and his panic slowly ebbed. The crystal-clear perception of the universe was restored to him, not, he knew, wholly by his own efforts. When he needed guidance in his first faltering steps, it would be there. Confident once more, like a high diver who had regained his nerve, he launched himself across the light-years. The galaxy burst forth from the mental frame in which he had enclosed it. Stars and nebulae poured past him in an illusion of infinite speed. Phantom suns exploded and fell behind as he slipped like a shadow through the cores. A cold, dark waste of cosmic dust which he had once feared seemed no more than the beat of a raven's wing across the face of the sun. The stars were thinning out. The glare of the Milky Way was dimming into a pale ghost of the glory he had known, and when he was ready, would know again. He was back, precisely where he wished to be, in the space that men called real. Chapter 47 Star Child. There, before him, a glittering toy no star child could resist, floated the planet Earth with all its peoples. He had returned in time. Down there on that crowded globe, the alarms would be flashing across the radar screens, the great tracking telescopes would be searching the skies, and history as men knew it would be drawing to a close. 1,000 miles below, he became aware that a slumbering cargo of death had awoken and was stirring sluggishly in its orbit. The feeble energies it contained were no possible menace to him, but he preferred a cleaner sky. He put forth his will, and the circling megatons flowered in a silent detonation that brought a brief, false dawn to half the sleeping globe. Then he waited, marshaling his thoughts and brooding over his still untested powers. For though he was master of the world, he was not quite sure what to do next. But he would think of something.
We hope you've enjoyed our presentation of 2001, A Space Odyssey by Arthur C. Clarke. Copyright 1968 by Arthur C. Clarke and Polaris Productions, Incorporated. Read by Dick Hill. Performance copyright 2000 by Brilliance Corporation. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliancedaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Corporation, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.